chapter to consider tonight. A lot of information, and boy, it's going through it. I'm looking at different points of, boy, this, we could go off on a tangent here, we'll go off on a tangent there. Excuse me, what was the invitation song?
215.
215? So, the challenge to get a few pictures. I really like this picture, and that picture's obviously from a different artist than these other three. They're trying to depict a situation. You know, while you were studying, did you think about this guy getting the mud on his eye, the clay on his eye, and then being told to wash? You know, what if he didn't go, but he went? Can you imagine the excitement when he got his eyes washed and he could see for the first time ever? Well, that would be just, and the people around him that would see this guy so lit up with excitement. And now he's going home and his folks, so we'll get into some interesting stuff. That's supposed to be his folks. And that's supposed to be the chief priest giving him grief. And then here he is worshiping the Lord. Pretty neat. I like it. Okay. Lauren, you're going to have to help me out.
I think Grant had the last
one. Grant had the last one. Okay. Well, it looks like you might. Trace. Trace, if you're up for the first one.
Okay.
And these are some powerful questions, too. So I almost forgot. But, you know, I missed the discussion last Wednesday. But Jesus in chapter 8, verses 39 through 59, he just finished a lengthy debate with the Jews. And once again, in verse 57, the Jews took up stones to kill him, yet Jesus simply passed by. I like that. Jesus simply passed by. Well, guess what? Verse 1 of chapter 9, we have it again. The text finds Jesus again passing by. But this time, it's a blind man that he's encountered. And in my reading, I found that no one really knows for sure the elapsed time from verse 59 of chapter 8 to verse 1 of chapter 9. So there's a little bit of uncertainty here, this time lapse. And this is also considered the sixth of the great signs from Jesus. If you remember, turning the water into wine, the nobleman's son, the lame man, feeding the 5,000, walking on the water, and now what we have here tonight, and then Lazarus, of course. So, Trace, if you're up for it, question number one, why might the disciples assume sin was involved when one was born blind? What did Jesus say was the reason he was born this way? How did Jesus heal him?
So, for the first part, this seems to be kind of like a common theme with the people around that area, that if someone was born a certain way with some kind of ailment or disability, that, you know, their parents were sinful or someone in their family was sinful. I didn't really get to research that a lot, but I know another example of that in Acts 28, verse 4, where Paul gets bit by a snake and the natives there think that
that's right,
doing something wrong.
Yep.
And so I thought that was interesting. But on the second part, it says, what did Jesus say was the reason? So Jesus simply said, in verse 3, that his parents were not sinful, but that the words of God should be revealed. So it was for a purpose, which I think is pretty awesome. It's pretty cool that, you know, that he got to be one that was honored by getting the sight back in front of everybody by Jesus himself. That's pretty cool. And then how did Jesus heal them? So he made clay out of the soil. He spit the soil and put clay on his eyes.
Yep. No. That's very good. Very good. Anyone else have something to add? Well, you know, it's kind of a, it's unfortunate, but it's kind of a human nature thing. If we think about all sin as a result of the failure in the Garden of Eden. But if you get past that, even people, if people tend, if they see calamity come upon someone, they think that it's something that they had done. So that's something that you got to guard against. Anyone else? Austin?
To that end, Kaufman summed it up best. He said, Christ is teaching here the idea of undeserved suffering, which is, of course, a common theme for us as Christians. And sometimes we can wonder, and the common question is, when maybe you might see that small child who is suffering from cancer, or why is this happening to them? Why is this happening to me? Thinking that because I'm innocent, I shouldn't have to go through this, as the opposite side of this coin, or someone else who has done worse things does deserve this. And the fact of the matter is, sometimes there is suffering that is undeserved. There are occasions, there are some sins that have physical consequences, but what's being described here is has nothing to do with that, and that's what Jesus is describing. I believe it was Clark, he talks about how he attributes this to the Hindus, that they devised a way for each ailment, what it was in a past life that they were guilty of. And it seems that the Jewish people in that day had a similar belief. They had a belief that there was some sins, some really heinous ones, and there was a special place in hell reserved for them. They would go down to the lowest hell. But then there was also a purgatory type of a place where you could go and serve X amount of time for certain sins and then come back and receive this kind of a punishment. So he says that, for instance, they would say a headache is punishment for having in a former state spoken irreverently to father or mother. Madness, a punishment for having been disobedient to father or mother or one's spiritual guide. Epilepsy, having administered poison to one. Pain in the eyes, a punishment for having coveted another man's wife. And blindness, a punishment for having killed his mother. So take that with a grain of salt, obviously, but they had some odd beliefs, and even these Jewish people, despite there being nothing in the Bible that lends itself to this type of transmigration of souls, is what it's referred to, but there you have it.
Yeah. Anyone else? Dakota? Yeah,
that's kind of interesting. I think you said maybe Kaufman said that. I had the same idea, as it reminds me of the caste system in Hinduism, and kind of what it's derived off of is the fact that a certain type of life in the past, and they may come back as a person high in the hierarchy of life, and may come back as an ant, and may come back as a cockroach, just kind of depending on what they've done in a past life. And as Austin said, you know, this is a concept that's born in the scripture, and you know, once again, it seems they err not knowing scriptures, because if you look at Ezekiel 18, in verse 20, you see that the soul whose sins shall die. The son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor the father bear the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself. So here we see the spiritual process of a person is responsible for their own free will decision to sin, and they therefore bear the consequences. But just because somebody has physical consequences as a matter of existing in a world that's got death, illness, and sickness doesn't mean that they necessarily get something to bring that particular thing on themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. We've got a passage here in Luke that kind of echoes this a little bit. Barty,
yeah, I agree with what's been said. I think real good insight. The point I wanted to make was the way Jesus heals him is, you know, a little bit disgusting, maybe, at least from our, you know, spitting on the ground and making clay. But to me, I thought about it a little bit, and obviously I don't think there's any way we can say for sure why Jesus did this way, but it does evoke the creation itself, I think, because man was created out of the dust, the earth, clay, and Jesus breathed, or God breathed upon that clay to bring it to life. And as we've learned with COVID in the last year or two, you can't breathe out and breathe in without fluid, without, you know, saliva. essentially, without air droplets, water droplets passing out of your mouth. So in a way, Jesus is evoking imagery of the creation by the very way he makes this man able to see. He's claiming to be God.
Yeah, Job was used as another example, although he suffered greatly. He was not guilty of sin. I read from a writer named Hendrickson, suggested that some Jewish rabbis held to the idea that Esau tried to murder Jacob still in the womb. And I said, wow, this is really crazy stuff. So there's a lot of weird ideas out there. We're going to have to keep moving. Number two, Lauren, if you're up for this one. Why were the people confused about this man's identity? Why was there a division among the Jews about Jesus after this miracle? What did the blind man initially believe about Jesus? Verses 18 through 17.
So why are the people confused about his identity? Well, they knew him as a blind beggar. Likely they went by him every day, but they didn't really see him as a person. Probably didn't engage him as a beggar. Healed and openly conversing. He's obviously different. Looks different. Sounds different. Engages them in a different way. So he's really the same guy.
Yeah. He's excited.
Right. They weren't paying any attention. Some recognized, for the second, why was there division among the Jews about Jesus after this miracle? Well, some recognized that healing of the blind could only be a sign from God. In Luke 4:18, Jesus quotes from, I think it's a little altered quote from Isaiah 61:1. It says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, bring liberty to the captives, and recovery of sight to the blind, set liberty to those who are oppressed, proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." So many recognize that this was extraordinary miracle among miracles that this had never happened before. But others accused him, saw him as a sinner because they accused him of breaking the Sabbath or the rules that they had established around the Sabbath. So that's why there's division among them. What did the blind man initially believe about Jesus? Verse 11, the formerly blind man, in verse 11, called Jesus man. By verse 17, he recognizes Jesus' his power is extraordinary and calls Jesus prophet.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Anyone else on question number two?
So, basically when they said, why was there a division among the Jews about Jesus after this miracle? I was reading some part of John where Jesus explained to some of the Jews that they had
number two. Verse 13, Kaufman believes this was before the entire Sanhedrin, this gathering here. Seemed kind of surprising, but how much time elapsed? Because I started out thinking the first part of question number two, why were the people confused about this man's identity? Well, that morning he was a blind man. He was that blind guy that lived over there with his parents, and now there's excitement, as Lauren illustrated. Okay, Austin?
One brief thing. A possible reason why Jesus may have made the clay was because it was the Sabbath and to evoke this continuing lesson he's trying to teach them about the fact that their Sabbath rules are garbage and don't have any belonging in there. Of course, Jesus could have just spoken his blindness be gone, but that could be a possible reason.
I'm glad you pointed that out because I read somewhere where making clay was against
administering medicine was one of the...
Well, and saliva supposedly was believed to have had medicinal traits and putting that into clay and all right, question number three, Malin, if you'd like it, if I can get this thing to change. Question number three, why did the Jews call for the blind man's parents? What was their response to the questions from the Jews? What lessons might we learn from their lack of support toward their son? That's verses 18 through 23.
So we see that they still don't believe, and you know, they keep digging and digging until they get the answers they want. They keep trying to, you know, keep uncover some, you know, discredit Jesus, the blind man. So, I believe that's what they're trying to do, and they might also, you know, be trying to prove, you know, if there was any kind of collusion. And one of the commentators suggested, you know, that's why they were doing it, to see if there's collusion between Jesus and the blind man. So the second question, what was their response to the question from the Jews? I mean, it was pretty plain and simple. You know, yes, it's our son. Yes, he was blind. So those are the things they knew, but they didn't know, I guess, that maybe they didn't witness it. So they didn't know for sure why he had been able to see. And that's why the parents instead asked him. He can tell you he's old enough. So the third part, what lesson might we learn from the lack of support towards their son? Well, I mean, it appears that they weren't actually there, so they didn't witness it. But probably, maybe they felt pressured into saying this because of they didn't want to be persecuted as well, you know, considered a disciple of Jesus. So,
that's pretty much all I have on that. Okay. Yeah, good. I think you're right. Laura?
Last question of this question, what lessons might be learned from their lack of support for their son? So I think the lesson is the power of social shunning. Warren says there were two classes of expulsion from the synagogue. There was one that was pretty fast, light version, which was 30 days away from the synagogue, you know, closer to your friends or your wife than 4 cubits. But the severe one was complete religious, social, and economic expulsion. So basically, in a day's work, it could be canceled. So, I mean, and we see this as a very powerful thing in Genesis 2:18. God, you know, recognized that we're that way, so it's not good for man to be alone. So he made marriage, family, and so forth. But the devil uses it. His own ways in Exodus. So there's a law against it in Exodus 23:2. Do not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute, so as to turn after many to pervert justice, which eventually we see this come to full fruition.
Yep.
To Jesus. And we also see this, they'll use it as well in Revelation 13, verses 16 and 17. He causes all, both small and great, and rich and poor, and free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, that no one may buy or sell except one has the mark of the name of the beast and the number of his name.
Yeah, to be kicked out, to be out of the synagogue, was a big, big deal. You're right. Anyone else? Question number three. All right. I thought it was interesting how these parents were careful not to show knowledge of Jesus. I find it hard to believe that this guy, after getting his eyes opened up, wouldn't have headed home and to see his parents. And they dodged the question a little bit, but they know better than to acknowledge Jesus. Or there was going to be a lot of persecution. And you know, many people today are like that. You know, many people today, like these parents, they feel no obligation to speak out in defense of the truth. And that's something maybe it's for us to do a good gut check once in a while. Okay, question number four. Yep. That was Jesus talking. Okay, question number four. Logan, if you would like it, how did they try to discredit Jesus this time? How did the former blind man respond? Does his logic typify how Jesus expected the people to come to the conclusion that he was from God? Verses 24 through 33.
So
the raising the accusation that he's a sinner. We know he's a sinner. And as for how he responds, he's very honest in everything he's saying here. It's kind of amazing, his response is. You know, you can imagine sensory overload, right? The fact that he's this collected with these Pharisees, these Jews coming against him is pretty amazing. But he says, I don't know if he's a sinner or not. You know, you can kind of see him reasoning with himself and you know, searching for the truth as this conversation goes on, because it goes, I don't know if this man is a sinner or not. He's a man. Later he says, we've already talked about it, he says he's a prophet. So he's starting to realize, he's like, wait a second, he gave me sight. No one that isn't from God could do that. So he at least has to be a prophet. So it's really interesting to see that progression as this conversation goes on. Does this logic typify how Jesus expected the people to come to the conclusion that he was from God? I think I pretty much just answered it.
Yeah, that question, that's a yes. You know, I and this is funny because only us older folks will remember this, but the third question there, I believe it's a yes. And remember back, there was an old TV show, a cop show called Dragnet. Remember Dragnet, where the detective said, just the facts, ma'am. In part of the story, just the facts, ma'am. And that's what this guy's trying to talk to, is just the facts. Without, he can't suggest or dream up different things. He has to stay to the facts. And that's, again, an important lesson for us sometimes. Anyone else? Question number four. Bart?
I like how they ask him basically if he's a sinner. And he says, well, I don't know. First thing he says is, I don't know. But then if you notice later, it's like he's thinking about it, as Logan said, as they're discussing. He says, you know, we know that God doesn't hear sinners. And this man is obviously heard by God. And so he's really answering the question at the end of this dialogue that he can't be a sinner and have this problem.
I agree. Austin, you were getting ready to say something.
Well, to add on to that, because of his logic, initially they say, give God the glory, which is a change of pace for them, because they're used to saying, oh, you're doing this through the power of the devil or through the power of Beelzebub or something of that nature. Now they're saying, and understanding the fact that devils don't do good things to people. So this isn't the power of the devil. This is God. And they say, give God the glory. Okay, that's a step in the right direction. But by this man's own logic, and by biblical logic even, if he's not from God, he could do nothing. So again, they're backed into a corner where they either have to accept Jesus is the Son of God, and that he is from God, or they have to believe a lie, because the evidence is right there.
Yeah. And Joshua 7, verse 19. Oh, I got that. Joshua 7, verse 19 is when Joshua confronted Achan and was trying to get... And this phrase, give God the glory, is evoked to try to encourage someone to be truthful. And I think they tried to discredit Jesus' name through intimidation. I think they were in this guy's face. And you know, some of us have witnessed intimidation being tried on us by other people. And brethren, shame on any of us that allow ourselves to be intimidated by a brother, a sister, an evangelist, the authorities, whoever. You know, when it comes to obeying God, we need to stand up for the Lord, his will, his teachings, and for one another when necessary. We don't need to cower. I love the end of verse 27. And I found myself wondering if he was sincerely asking this question or if he was poking the dog. You know, if he was trying to, okay, you guys have been giving me a bad time. I'm going to flip the table on you a little bit here. And also, verses 30 through 33, aren't those great? We'll get to them in a minute, but aren't those great? From a man who likely a few hours ago was a poor blind beggar, the truth has emboldened him, hasn't it? All right, anything else? Okay. Oh, Logan, I'm sorry. I thought I saw a hand.
Yeah, just a quick point. This man's blind, and in verse, let's see, no, I had just a second. Okay, so verse 31, he says, this is kind of when he starts his own teaching. He's actually starting to teach the Pharisees here.
Yep.
Now, we know that God does not hear sinners. So, this man's blind, and he couldn't read a Bible. I very much doubt they had Braille copies of the Bible back in, you know, at whatever time period this took place. So, he knew the scriptures well enough to know.
From what he'd heard.
He had heard this. He had listened intently. So, this man that is saying these things and is teaching the Pharisees here is already a pretty devout follower here. So.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. All right. Question number five, then. Bart, this is for you if you'd like. Why did they feel that they could ignore his sound, logical argument? Why might Jesus have chosen to have another interaction with him? How does this man's attitude compare with others that Jesus healed? This is verses 34 through 38.
Well, as Dennis pointed out in this amazing sermon a couple weeks ago, you know, here this guy is having, you know, the best day of his life, and it's turned into day of his life. Impossible to do that, actually. But what should have been something that was an amazing day and everybody congratulating him and being astounded, instead he's facing opposition. And verse 34 tells us they cursed him, you're completely born in sins, and then they cast him out. And it's because he has the temerity, as has been pointed out, to lecture these guys. These guys are the experts. They're the PhDs. And scrub doesn't come and you know, it'd be like if you went into the college system now and tried to lecture somebody. They'd say, get out of here, where's your degree? And so he doesn't have the right to do that. He's testifying for Jesus. He asks him sarcastically, do you want to be his disciple? And that's all they can stand. So they cast him out. And they're not really thinking logically, obviously. The Pharisees aren't thinking logically at this point. They're thinking emotionally. They're threatened by everything that's happening.
Tunnel vision.
Yeah, right. Yep. Their power base is threatened, and so they're just, you know, they'd like, I'm sure, kill this blind man if they could, as well as Jesus, obviously. As Jesus then seeks, this man has testified on Jesus' behalf. He has, you might say he's witness for the Lord. He has spoken out as we are called to do for Jesus in our lives, and so Jesus then seeks him out and basically treats him for the confession that we give as Christians, that Jesus is the Son of God and died for our sins. And so he makes that confession, and or a similar confession at least. He doesn't know about the Lord's death and resurrection yet. And Jesus then receives his worship. And so it's an amazing story. And Austin probably put this question in because back in chapter 3, the third miracle was the healing of the person who was paralyzed. And it's dramatically different. I don't know if John put these two men in here for contrast purposes. We can't say that entirely sure, but we do know that the man back in chapter 3 went to the temple and then went to the Pharisees and told on Jesus, or at least told them who it was. And we don't have any idea that there was a confrontation between them. And then it says, John says, it was after this thing that the person of Jesus. So it seems to me to be a contrast. And I think that's obviously the case in life. John's pointing out something that we all know. Every human receives blessings from God. We all receive blessings every day. And the way we react to those blessings determines our future. If we just take them for granted, ignore God, and go about our business, then we're lost. If we realize that nothing we receive is from ourselves, and we obey God, then we'll be saved. And it seems to me that we have two types of individuals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to the John chapter 5. I went to that the lame man there as well, and found it interesting that he just turned around and ran back to the leaders and told them, no, it was Jesus. I thought that was an interesting contrast. Was that kind of what you were hoping for with that question? Go ahead.
Yes. I was thinking about him, but also about the 10 lepers that he healed, right?
Yeah.
And there was only the one who came back and expressed gratitude. And this blind man is a lot like that 10th leper, that one that came back and showed the appreciation. Jesus healed a lot of different people, but there's only certain ones that are mentioned, and I think for a reason. We know that Jesus healed many more, which are not written in this book, as it says at the end of the book of John. But these are written that you may believe, and this is one of those to show the impact that Jesus had in the life of this man. As Logan already pointed out, this was a guy who listened to the word of God. This was a man who believed, and some speculate that the reason he is told to go to the pool of Siloam is much like Naaman the Syrian is told to go dip in the Jordan River as a test of his faith, knowing that he has faith, or suspecting perhaps that he has faith. Here's a test, go wash yourself in the pool of Siloam. He goes and does that.
Yep.
So comparing him with some of these others, he stands out to me as one of the best examples of a person who was healed, and it affects him in such a way that he is sought out by the Lord a second time after having heard that he's been cast out, suffered persecution on the name of, because of Jesus. And maybe he's one of the first that has suffered persecution on Jesus' behalf. Maybe not the first, but one of the first. And when he's confronted with who is the Son of God, he immediately believes and he immediately starts worshiping as all of these others should have rightfully done.
Anyone else? Question?
Something that struck me about this man was how similar he was to what Jesus went through in the last chapter. Here the Sadducees and Pharisees are ridiculing him. They kind of insult him. They insult him here. They answered him, "You were completely born in sins." And that's exactly what they did in chapter 8 when Jesus presented them with an argument they couldn't get around. They said, "Aren't you a Samaritan? Don't you have a demon?" And I really like that connection. And then something that I also thought of, I really like when verse 35, when Jesus comes and finds the man again the second time. And what I thought of was what Uncle Malin gave a lesson on this Sunday. You know, Psalm 100, we are the sheep of his pasture. If God knows that we will respond to him, he will come and find us.
Yeah, very good. No, I appreciate that point a lot. I had a note in here that Jesus recognized this man as a strong candidate and wanted to continue to encourage him. Anyone else? Question number 5. Okay. All right, question number 6. Landon, if you're up for it, how is judgment executed? By causing some to see and others to be blind? Why does Jesus say the blind have no sin? What is this referring to? This is verses 39 through 41.
For the first part of this question, John 3, God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that through him the world might be saved. And so he's going to cause those who are blind that want to see to be able to see him spiritually, but also those who refuse to see God to be blind. For the second part of the question and the third part of the question, why does Jesus say the blind have no sin, and what is this referring to? He is making a comparison here in these verses. The healed man here, he's willing to learn, he's humble, and he's blind to himself, but he's seen in regard to Jesus, whereas the Pharisees and the Sadducees are blind to their own sins. They're blind to their pride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Anyone else? Anything to add? Levi.
We've been going through the Book of Psalms in a monthly study at our household, and there's a central theme that I've been seeing in a lot of Psalms and about God. That is, God upholds the righteous, and those who hate him will not stand. Jesus is God, and this is the way God works. And Psalms are inspired by God, and I want to read a couple of the Psalm verses that I think convey the central theme in this chapter of uplifting the humble, but God does not let the evil stand. Psalm 5:4, "For you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness, nor shall evil dwell in you. The boastful shall not stand in your sight, and you hate all workers of iniquity. You shall destroy those who speak falsehood." And then I saw Psalm 7. Drop my pen. Okay, Psalm 7, verse 10. My defense is of God, who saves the upright in heart. I like this. God is a just judge, and God is angry with the wicked every single day. And then I also have, I'm reading a lot of Psalms here. I'm sorry.
Fine, go ahead.
I really like these themes here.
We have three more minutes.
Psalm 10, verse 6 says, speaking about someone who is evil, he has said in his heart, I shall not be moved. I shall never be in adversity. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and oppression. I kind of like to think this is just a complete shadow of the Pharisees. I mean, a lot of these psalms have messianic qualities to them, and a lot of them speak about Jesus, and these are perfectly, you know, exemplifying what the Pharisees are. Under his tongue is trouble and iniquity. And this is another one shadows the Pharisees. He sits in the lurking places of the villages. In the secret places, he murders the innocent. That's what the Pharisees do. That's what they look to do. And last one, I'll keep on going with this. And this is the one that has a lot of messianic qualities, Psalm 18, and I really like this one. Psalm 18, verse 25. With the merciful, you will show yourself merciful. With a blameless man, you will show yourself blameless. With a pure, you will show yourself pure. And with the devious, you will show yourself true. For you will save the humble people, but will bring down haughty looks. So this is just saying this is what the Pharisees are like. This blind man, trusts God, he has faith, and God will be a shield to him. But to the Pharisees who hate him and kill people in the streets, he will give him no mercy.
They'll still be blind, won't they? Yeah, very good, very good. Anyone else? Austin?
Just one little short verse to add to all of this, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7, for we walk by faith and not by sight.
Fair enough. Anything else? Appreciate everyone's participation this evening. Good lesson, or good study, good chapter, a lot of material. Maybe we'll see some more lessons trickling out over the next few months and maybe a year or so in this chapter. Appreciate, again, everyone's participation.